Welcome to Manager Tools. My directs are too busy, part one. And the questions this cast answers are, what do I do when my directs say they're too busy? Should I protect my directs when they say they're too busy? And is busyness a legitimate defense? If you'd like answers to these questions and more, keep listening. Making great hires is not easy. And anyone that tells you it's easy, they're not making great hires, let's face it. Trying to find a candidate and then determining whether or not they'll be an exceptional fit for your organization today and where the company will be in 5, 10, 15 years, it's a daunting task. Let's face it. It's difficult to know how to hire without having the skills to hire well. But let's face it, great people can overcome average processes. But there is no amount of process improvement that can overcome average hires. So if you're looking for a way to shortcut the system, to fast track your organization's way to great hires, send us an email to customerservice@manager-tools.com. And we'll talk to you about coming on site or virtually to deliver our effective hiring manager conference. In 1 to 2 days, your entire organization can have all the skills you need to make exceptional hires.
I'm really excited that we're talking about this. I think a lot of managers deal with it.
Oh my gosh, I deal with it. Dude, love it.
Really?
This is so common. Absolutely. I think a lot of people deal with that.
I think you're right.
I'm too busy. In my experience, many of us feel like we're too busy, even when we're not legitimately busy. So I think it's just a really easy first line of defense is probably the wrong word, but kind of that, right? We all feel busy. We feel like we're running around. We're doing a bunch of stuff. So the answer to, can you do this thing, being I'm too busy, feels perfectly logical for many of us much of the time.
That's interesting that you say it that way. I find that when I compare my busyness to other people's, theirs is easily, significantly lower, and therefore, I don't feel that they're busy.
Oh, no. I completely agree. I don't think they're that busy. I do think they feel like they are because they've convinced themselves that they are. Yeah, totally. You're completely right. I'm completely right. If we looked at it objectively, we would know who's truly busy and not. But most of us don't look at our degree of busyness objectively.
I think what people describe when they say busy, they may mean I'm using all my minutes.
Yeah, using all my minutes.
Mm-hmm. And I have a really hard time with that because I think the way they're using their minutes is wrong.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So wrong. Agreed.
So, okay. We agree that people, all people, directs, say, and they say this for one-on-ones. They say, oh my gosh, I can't do one-on-ones and it's because I'm too busy, which is laughable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more to it, that defense. We'll honor it enough to admit that there's a little more to it. And also, we think this is laughable. So if you've been dealing with this, good news. Today, we're going to cover busyness, its causes, and managerial responses.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to cover people being too busy for one-on-ones, people being too busy for delegation, and too busy for general workload increases. So busyness all around, which is what I find true of busyness, is that it is constantly being discussed, and I see sometimes very little of it.
That's funny. That is so funny. It's too funny.
It's all around us and not happening.
Exactly. So busyness, its causes, and managerial responses. Let's start there. By addressing the busyness defense generally as a concept in the workplace, busyness is misunderstood, misused, and misrespected, but also ultimately misguided, generally.
Yeah.
To be clear, your directs using busyness as a defense is almost always wrong, and therefore you should ignore and fight through it.
Yes.
Now, you might have heard it. I said almost. There is a very narrow window where the I'm too busy defense actually is applicable. And that very narrow window is when you ask for more from your very best performers and mm-hmm. they say they are too busy, you believe them.
Yeah.
Because that is a legitimate thing sometimes. Otherwise, again, if it falls outside of those very strict confines, busyness as a defense is weak, on the order of being, in many cases, pathetic for its triteness and lack of originality. I mean, everyone uses it. It's just such a simple, far too easy to use excuse when anybody, except, again, except your top performer, claims busyness. They're both insulting you for not knowing how busy they are and for not being smart enough to see directly through their lack of busyness.
So true. I find top performers tend to say yes to too much work sometimes.
Yeah. And oh my gosh.
So if they say yes so much that when they finally say no, it's probably true.
Probably true.
Mm-hmm. And I hear so often from people about their busyness. I could rail on this topic, and we're going to a little bit. Mm-hmm. So there's this thing that people do. That they want to be seen as busy, right?
Yeah. Makes you look good. You seem important.
Yeah. Yeah. One reason that it's not always true that people are as busy as they state that they are is because of egotistic work inflators. And if you're wondering, excuse me, that's new. You're right. It is. And it's we're using it to describe when people say they're super busy because they want to impress you with how important they are. And you know who these people
are. You do.
Are.
You can envision them in your mind's eye. Close your eyes and imagine these people that just want to convince you how busy they are to make them look cool.
Right. The Journal writes funny and serious articles on these people at least once a year. They don't have time to help you because they're super busy. They don't have time to talk to you or even stay in touch because their startup is having a moment. They say they're triple booked on their calendar, which is just stupid. And it's an insult to the people that they're talking to because then they think you're dumb enough to believe that they actually are. Okay, so we recommend you dump these people as friends and don't ever hire
them. Don't talk to them. Don't be their friend.
Because they're, you know, really not the best in that way. And frankly, I think you and I, as people who focus a lot on making sure that we spend our time on the right stuff. Mm-hmm. You and I probably see more of this than almost anybody of just people, personal work. Mostly, these people kind of bring up the personal part of life where it's like, I know people who say, oh yeah, I'm really busy. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, if you are not scheduled down to the minute, you're not busy. And if you are busy, I wonder if what you're doing is the right stuff.
Yeah, that's so. Okay, I was going to say that. I'm like, what are you working on, though? Because I know what you do. Maybe not. Now, I know recently, Kate, I feel like we put out a podcast and we invented an acronym. And we said something like, in the history of this company, we've only invented one acronym.
I don't think it was an acronym. I think it was the alliteration of stay, seek.
Oh, yes, I remember.
Sleuth.
Yes, it was the alliteration. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Okay. Good. Then my inventing, I suppose, some acronyms to help us walk through these examples won't be out of the norm at all. It'll be perfectly logical, perfectly necessary. So we're gonna need some acronyms in today's cast. And we're going to start with the saying, I suppose, for egotistical work inflators. We're going to call these people EWEs. EWEs, right? Egotistical work inflator. They are, in part, so busy because they spend so much time telling everybody else how busy they are. That's why they're so busy. Because they're so busy convincing people how busy they are.
Sure.
And it's just not true. There's a great story of the exact opposite behavior being true. And if you're a sports fan, this next story might appeal to you. Several years ago, a new player joined the LA Lakers when Kobe Bryant, one of the most amazing leaders in the history of the LA Lakers, and a member of the team who won 5 NBA championships was a member of the team.
Sure.
Now, this new player on the Lakers would come to the gym at 6 a.m. an hour before team practice started so that they could get a work in before practice. And mm-hmm. it would actually surprise you how rare this behavior is amongst people who are professional players in a sport, and therefore they're really honing their craft. It would surprise you how few people do it, but here we are. Nevertheless, as the story goes, this individual noticed that Kobe was already in the gym when they arrived, again, an hour before team practice begins. Kobe was a veteran, and this new individual was relatively new and surprised and impressed, obviously, that Kobe was in there even an hour earlier than they were. So, to show respect and perhaps get a little respect for himself, he resolved to come in to the gym earlier than Kobe. That's the goal, right? I'm going to come in earlier. So he came to the gym at 5:30 a.m. the next week. And to his surprise, Kobe was still already there. So here we go. The next week, he showed up at 5 a.m. Pretty sure at this point, 2 hours before practice starts, surely I'm going to beat Kobe in. And alas, Kobe was still there before him. The following week, you guessed it, showed up at 4:30 a.m. And who was already in the gym practicing? Kobe. And yes, the next week he showed up at 4, and there was Kobe. Ultimately, to be named one of the 10 greatest NBA players of all time, to no one's surprise.
Yeah. And of course, the moral of this story about busyness and egotistic work inflators is that Kobe Bryant was one of the very, very few people who worked that hard, and everybody else could have, yeah. And they didn't.
You could have. The gym is open to you as a player.
Oh, yeah. They have it for you whenever you want. And the people who weren't working that hard still considered themselves incredibly busy.
Oh, yeah, they did.
But if you ask Kobe, they not only were not busy, mm-hmm. saying that they were busy would have been a lie.
Oh, right.
Which is inaccurate. Maybe not a lie, but it would have been inaccurate.
Oh, for sure, like a stab. If somebody tells you, oh my gosh, I'm so slammed, you're like, okay, well, dude, I was in here at 4 a.m. Yo, so yeah. There's that.
Right.
How busy can you be?
Yeah. And some people listening might be thinking, there are people. They have kids, and those kids have to go to a lot of things.
Yeah, absolutely,
and
they do.
If you have multiple children who have to go multiple places, like soccer, football, ballet, okay, you probably spend a great deal of your time busily ferrying them. Uh-huh. So you might be thinking of this. This might be resonating with you because you might be thinking, oh my goodness, the time I have to dedicate to something like being at the gym at 4 a.m. would be small. Here's the thing. You might be thinking then, well, obviously, that would cut into family time. And so that would mean that Kobe Bryant didn't have a family first mentality, except that is not what we have heard from his family. His family had said for years, and even years before this story was part of, you know, what we learned about him as a player and as a dedicated professional, because that's his profession, years in advance of this story, we heard that from Kobe Bryant's family that he was devoted to them, that he was a wonderful family yeah. man and spent a ton of time with his family. So
yeah, not taking time away from his family to hone his craft, to get better at his craft. There's also a hidden message in this story. And the hidden message in the story being that the guy who joined the Lakers was an NBA player, obviously.
Right, so had exposure to the social circle.
Exactly. These people are in their circle. You would hear stories about other NBA players, obviously. And he never heard even a single mention of Kobe's legendary hard work. It's not even so much as a rumor that this guy works really, really hard, like so much harder than everyone else. And we'd proffer a reason, because Kobe didn't talk about it. It is weakness and smallness that drives the egotistical bragging about busyness. Showing off to other people about how busy you are often doesn't mean one is truly all that busy. If someone's great, they don't talk about their workload or their busyness because they know that the cost of greatness is boundless work. So talking about what is a guarantee to be good at your job doesn't require you to tell everybody about it.
Yes, one begets the other. And so having to talk about the fact that you are doing the one belies the success that you would be seeing if you were doing it.
Exactly.
So if you have to constantly tell people, ha ha ha, you're probably not that busy or that great.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So those are our EWEs.
Yeah, EWEs. Mm-hmm.
And then there's also another type of busyness inflator, the fearful work inflator, which we're going to call FEWEs. These are the people who know they're either not that busy, but they worry about their position. They worry about being laid off. They worry about being fired, or they're actually busy with stuff that doesn't matter, isn't talked about, or doesn't contribute to organizational success. Mm-hmm. And, oh gosh, I have worked with this person before. And we're going to share a story about Mike and someone he's worked with. I will also say they look very busy sometimes. They do, the FEWEs do a really good job of moving around a lot.
Yeah.
Like, physical busyness.
Yeah.
The person I know just was constantly in other offices, constantly moving around, constantly talking.
Yeah, looking a little frantic, would you say? Like that kind of look of like constantly a rush.
Yes, that. And also just very little time, dedicated alone time at a desk, which in engineering is usually something that you need to do. You need to spend
a lot of
hours
the job,
a day.
Actually.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of it. And most engineers prefer it that way, which is probably how it ends up like that.
Yeah.
But okay, so FEWEs. These are people who they struggle. And aside from my example, we have one that happened to Mike when he was a vice president, VP at Bell Atlantic. And then when he moved into his huge office, there was a corner, like a full corner of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Full of printed reports that the organization produced and distributed. This is in like roughly 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the year 2000.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
That's a devastating thing to have.
It's actually 24 years ago, but whatever. I don't need to be precise about it. 20 sounds better.
It is not the moment for me to say hush to you. And... that's a devastating...
No, I know. I'm so sorry.
Oh, a number of years ago. When we say it like that, the fact that the reports were printed on like green bar paper doesn't sound that bad. It doesn't sound that weird because it was so long ago. However, if you know what that is, you know that this is like pre everybody's desk having a computer.
Oh, yeah. Like way before 2000. Like prior to... many of us beginning our careers, for that matter, is when these charts were actually being used by individuals for, I'm going to say, useful purpose. Like they were, like actual work product was on them.
Yeah.
The thing is, so for Mike, in this case, he didn't like that these boxes of reports were in his office. Again, to Kate's point, there's like this pile of boxes with all these reports in the corner. So he wanted to get rid of them. So he asked about them. Only to discover that there were several people in his organization who did nothing but prepare these reports.
That's it. That's their whole job.
That was their job. And again, in 2000, these are not useful part of professional life generally. So then he dug a little bit deeper, obviously. Like, I mean, okay, well, we're still creating them. Surely someone's using them. And he also discovered that his peers to whom these reports were actually sent, like the individuals for whom they were bound and created, never read them. No one ever read them. Worse yet, the people who produced them, the people who were employed to produce these reports knew no one read them.
Again, I'm just reminded of the person I know.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. I know someone who produced a lot of things. And then every 6 weeks, the thing would be updated. And but it was just about the time that you'd gotten used to using the one from the 6 weeks before. So, okay. Oh, I'm having flashbacks. It's not good. Okay. So then maybe you're asking, why wouldn't these people report, hey, this effort that I'm doing, this work that I'm doing is wasted and that's frustrating? And the answer is that there are fewies, they're fearful work inflators. They had a legitimate concern that they were doing work that was pure waste, and that if they were to put that out there, that they were, people were to know that they'd be next on the list for layoffs. And listen, being ethical isn't a suicide pact. As devastating as layoffs can be and as common as they are, too many of us have learned a kind of certain vulgar detachment from their cause of pain and suffering. We really shouldn't find fault with our employees for defending themselves when the loss of a job can be, you know, detached. Even the job that we're describing that these people had is detached from the system. It's like an appendage that doesn't have any, it's like a pinky toe.
Yeah.
Like doesn't have any use. So why wouldn't they have that fear?
Right.
That would just be something that if we decided, hey, if everybody knows you don't need your pinky toe, we'll just cut that sucker off. Mm-hmm. So let's not be, you know, we're not trying to shame people for being fearful in this particular.
Right. We hear about layoffs a lot.
Anecdote.
It seems to happen with no rhyme or reason or really great cause, frankly, in many cases.
A lot of the organization
hired too many people. So of course people are scared, fearful, obviously.
And they want to protect, you know, their family and their ability to pay their mortgage.
Absolutely.
So, okay, we can see why you wouldn't want to out yourself for that in that case. And we should cap this up by saying that Mike eliminated all the reports immediately and assigned the creation team to other more valuable work, which is what you should also do in a situation. Because there are people who want to hire, right? There's got to be three departments at Bell Atlantic hiring.
Exactly.
March 5th and 6th, we are hosting our two most popular events in Philadelphia. Tuesday that week, the 5th, we'll cover effective management. And Wednesday, the 6th of March, is communication. If you want to improve your skills in either area, come to Philly, see us. March 5th and 6th, you can sign up at manager-tools.com/training.
Okay, so going back to these types of individuals, we've found fewies to be far more common in the wild than yewies. Why? Because there's another type of busy talkers that are the biggest chunk of all, the hiding in plain sight fewies. That is, their job doesn't give them enough to do, but they're also not going to brazenly brag about it. So they simply do many, 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 many small things, including saying they're regularly, but without bragging, how busy they are.
Yes, they're constantly moving around.
So right, exactly, to your point. They're always moving around. They're seemingly in everybody's office all the time. And this report, this thing that we just got an update for last week is also, again, updated. And there's almost no changes that are recognizable to anybody else. But, I mean, we noticed a missing period, so we did a new copy, and that took a bunch of time. And this behavior is designed to help others' perceptions of them be, oh my gosh, I know that person. They're so busy. And this is also in part a response to layoff culture. They've mastered the art of looking busy, when in fact, the percentage of their work that actually matters to the organization is 50%, maybe even 30% of the work they do is actually valuable work. But the impression by everybody else in the organization is they are so busy. And this is by design.
It happens a lot, too, in places where there's salary work and things like this, where people just, they stay at their desk until 5.
Yeah.
Even if there's not that much to do.
Right.
And so people end up creating busy work. You know, it's interesting. Busy work gets a bad rep. Yeah. I gotta say, I think the bad reputation it gets is often used as a way to like push work off. Like, oh, that sounds like busy work. I have found, though, more frequently than managers pushing down busy work, people creating their own busy work.
Oh, yes.
So when I hear the words busy work, and I've heard it from a few people. When I hear the words busy work, I become quite chapped because my experience with busy work is that people create their own rather than managers creating it for them. Now, there are organizations that need to take a good hard look at the work at every level and decide if all of that work is useful because we really don't want to be in a situation where we delegate and you're delegating stuff that isn't useful. So we do want to pay attention.
Yeah.
So, okay, back to the FUEs. Biggest component of FUEs is neither the ones who do nothing of value but fear repercussions, or those who do too little and fear repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. The biggest group is those who simply use busyness as a standard defense and want to do what they want to do, or prefer to do what they do at the speed that they want to do it, and have adopted work inflation concepts to defend themselves against change of virtually all types. They don't actually, these people, act busy. They just keep to themselves, they don't like change, and they deploy FUE tactics to keep from having to change the workload.
Right. And folks, you might have heard that explanation and thought, yeah, that's fine. But it's really not fine. Why? Because if you defend yourself from change for a few years while the organization continues to grow and change around you, what you're in effect doing is lagging behind the remainder of the organization. If you're not growing and defending your own status quo, you're not growing. You're impeding the growth of the organization because you're dragging behind and in turn bringing the organization down with you. And we admit that there's some degree of flavor of the month managing that leads to this reflexive defensiveness, right? Ooh, this new exciting flavor of the month thing, which causes people that defense of, you know what, I'm just going to do my normal standard stuff because you're always having these bright, new, shiny, fancy ideas, but
this will go away.
This will go away. Exactly. I'm just going to do the things that I know will stick around. But folks, these FUEs essentially borrow the language of inflators to feed their disdain for change, adaptation, and growth. And as managers, it's our job to help them avoid irrelevance. They know not what they ask. They really don't, in some cases. They think they're asking not to change, but what they're asking for is you to allow them to make themselves irrelevant, which they will also really, really hate when they've become irrelevant and are no longer useful to the organization itself.
It's slightly different to and akin to the situation where younger people who don't really understand delegation want to protect the work that they're doing without changing it. And I see this a lot in software engineering. People don't want to accept delegation. What's odd, though, is if you do that enough times as a software engineer, you're not learning the next new language, the next new, you know, code situation. And then suddenly the code that you work on is obsolete.
Yeah.
Because you've just essentially pushed off progress to the point where what you're doing is not up to snuff. It's not on the bleeding edge, or it's not even on like the front edge. So similar kind of situations. And we hear about that a lot.
Yeah.
I
hear about that with so many things, so much of the time. And I think it's our jobs as managers to help people, to save people from themselves. And that sounds like a bit of an exaggeration. But I recently had a large conversation with a group that I was working with in Pennsylvania, Commonwealth Foundation. And we were talking about, okay, well, some of my people want to do one-on-ones. Other people on my team don't want to do one-on-ones. So should I just do one-on-ones with the people that want it? I'm like, okay, well, the problem is the people that don't want it today are the exact same people that are going to be mad at you a year from now when you're giving different and better opportunities to the other people on the team because you know what those people want. You know their career aspirations, what they want for the future, what they're interested in. And you're going to assign work to individuals based on what you know they want to do. And some people are going to get to do what they want. And the people you're not doing one-on-ones with will just get the other stuff. Yeah. Because a year ago, they refused to build a relationship with you. And they don't see it that way. Let me be perfectly clear. When they say, I don't want to do one-on-ones, they don't see it that way. But
they don't understand.
They don't understand. It's our jobs to protect them from themselves. That's all for this week, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll join you again next week to finish off today's topic.